So tonight's topic, one of my favorite topics, You Ruined My Life. Although that's not the full title. The full title is, actually, if you read the fine print, How to Get Over the You Ruined My Life Syndrome. I think it was Oscar Wilde who said, Always forgive your enemies. Nothing annoys them so much. Okay. And that's really sick advice. We're not going to talk about passive-aggressive shtick or how to milk the victim role. Actually, to the contrary, how to get out of it. It was Ann Landers. By the way, everyone heard that Dear Abby, her twin sister, she passed away this week. Dear Abby passed away this week, but her twin sister, two Jewish girls from Sioux City, Iowa. Yeah? You knew that? So Ann Landers said, Harboring a resentment is like giving rent-free space in your head to someone you don't even like. Or another way I heard it put one time, a resentment is like swallowing poison and waiting for the other guy to drop dead. Or perhaps even more graphically, the way I heard it once described is, a resentment is like lighting yourself on fire to kill your enemy from smoke inhalation. It never ever happened to me. I don't know, maybe it happened to you. It never happened to me. I never ever ever got a call at 3 in the morning while I was up sleepless and angry and resentful thinking about somebody who ruined my life. I never got that call at 3 a.m. from that person saying, Can you please stop thinking about me? I need to get some sleep. Never happened to you? Never happened to me yet. It's 3 in the morning. I can't sleep. This guy's sleeping like a baby. Okay, so there's no question about it. The resentments are not helping us. We're not gaining anything from it. And that when I carry a grudge, I don't hurt the person I'm carrying a grudge against. I hurt myself. There's no question about it. But this itself is not worthy of a whole discussion. This is actually basics. What I want to try to do is talk about something a little bit deeper, something from a Torah perspective, from a spiritual perspective, from a perspective of the soul, and try to understand on an even deeper level what these resentments are doing to us, why they're so toxic, and then obviously, most importantly, what would be the most important thing you'd want to hear?
How to get rid of
them, yeah, of course. Okay. So, there was a great spiritual master by the name of Reb Zushya. He was the disciple of the disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. And when he was on his deathbed, he was crying, and his students were all with him. And they said, Master, why are you crying? He says, I fear judgment. So they said, you lived a life of perfect piety, and we don't understand what in the world you would have to fear. So he says, my children, maybe you're misunderstanding. I'm not worried that I'll get to the heavenly court and they'll demand from me, Zushya, why weren't you like Abraham, our father? Zushya, why weren't you like Moses, our teacher? I'm concerned I will get there and they'll look at me and they say, Zushya, why weren't you like Zushya? So it's axiomatic when we say that every single soul that was sent into this world was sent with a particular purpose, with a mission. Okay, and my life story is that mission. And nobody else can live that mission for me. Only I can live my mission. Which is why, by the way, when I think that when sometimes you say to somebody, get a life, it's not specific enough. You should say, preferably your own. Get your own life. Reminds me of a joke, by the way. They say, what's the last thing that a codependent sees before he dies? Somebody else's life flashes before his eyes. So I have my mission, I have my purpose, and that's my story. Okay? That's my story. And I think what's really important is for each one of us to sort of get in touch with our story and to look at it that way. I'll tell you why. I think it's kind of interesting that what we call a good life, or what we think we would consider a good life, is nothing at all like what we would consider a good story. You ever think about that? You know what I mean? You're at a shiva, and somebody says, ugh, Nebuch, he had such a bad life. Well, what does that mean? What do you mean he had a bad life? Oh, he had such heartache, such challenges, such loss. What a bad life. Now, why is that a bad life? I mean, bad is a moral judgment. Bad would mean he was a really, really talented, capable person with a lot of resources. He wasted it all by being selfish and having no relationships. That would be a bad life. But a hard life? A challenging life? A difficult life? Why is that a bad life? That's not a bad life. If you were at a story like that, would you call that a good story? Imagine you're reading a novel. Our protagonist wakes up exactly at 7 a.m., just like he had set his alarm. He goes to the kitchen, has his cup of coffee, takes out the milk. There's plenty of milk. Nobody just put it back in the fridge with a drop left. Pours the milk in the coffee. Gets in his car, starts on the first try. Drives to work. There's no traffic jam. He hit every green light. He was 10 minutes early for work. He played some computer games. At 9 o'clock, his boss said hi, didn't give him any extra work. I mean, exciting so far? I mean, I'll keep going. 11 o'clock, he broke early for lunch. He had a tuna fish sandwich. It was rather tasty. I mean, if you're reading this book, at what point do you say, when is something going to happen? Where's the action? But if this is your day, thank God, it's smooth sailing, things are good. Should just stay this way, don't rock the boat. A narrative has to have conflict, it has to have an antagonist just as much as it has to have a protagonist. There has to be a character arc, the character grows, he struggles, and that's a good story. That's a good story, but the minute that that's our life, oh please, don't give me anything interesting. God forbid it should be anything that's character building. Just keep it really simple for me. We call that a good life. So I think what's crucial is to embrace our life as a story. But not just a story, it's my story. The story that God is telling me about me and of which I'm the main character. There was one time I was invited to speak at a group called Gilda's Club. And I don't know if you know what it is, but it's named after Gilda Radner, Aleha HaShalom. She was a very talented Jewish woman, a comedic actress. She passed away at a young age from ovarian cancer. And her husband, also a Jew, Gene Wilder. Yeah, Frisco kid? Yeah, okay, good. We can mention other credits as well, but Frisco Kid is like, you know, in a Jewish audience. You got to mention that. And so Gene Wilder made this foundation called Gilda's Club for his late wife. And it's a place where people who have been diagnosed with cancer, they can get together and they have support. And so I was invited to speak at one of these centers in a Midwestern city. And I got concerned when I showed up when they told me that the topic was faith in the face of adversity. Now, you want to go into a room full of people diagnosed with a terminal illness, and you're going to speak to them about faith in the face of adversity. So I made a decision right then and there. If anyone tells me, shut up, Rabbi, you don't know what you're talking about, that's offensive, I'm going to say, you're right, I'm sorry, and I'm going to go home. But then I realized there's an issue with that. Because I'm a rabbi, I'm going to come in and I'm going to start teaching Torah. Okay, I'm going to start teaching Torah, and they're going to say, shut up, rabbi, go home, we don't like it. Now, okay, they don't like me, that's fine. But, you know, I just besmirched the Torah. You know, it's not their fault, it's not the Torah's fault that I'm not eloquently explaining in a way that they can relate to. They're going to think bad of the Torah, God forbid. So I decided, you know, the only solution for this is I'm just going to totally make something up. And that way, if they like it, they like it. But if they don't like it, I'll be like, yeah, what do you want? I made it up. So I get into Gilda's club, and I start saying like this. I say, you know, I was thinking the other day. Now, that part was true, because I had been thinking the other day. I said, you know, I was thinking the other day that the French New Wave cinema, that the directors of the French New Wave cinema, they used to get together a lot, and they used to discuss film theory, film criticism, cinema, you know, the art of it and the idea of it. So one time they were sitting around, I guess in Paris, probably at some coffee shop. That's how I imagine it. In my imagination, they're wearing little berets and everything and drinking their little coffees. And they're having this little cinematic verbrengen or whatever it is they call it. And the French New Wave directors are there, and they ask, who's the greatest director of all time? And François Truffaut says, no problem, hands down, the greatest director of all time is Alfred Hitchcock. So the other guys say, okay, that's fine. François, you can say it's Hitchcock, but you got to defend your premise. So Truffaut says, okay, I'm going to defend my premise. In Hitchcock's entire body of work, in all of his dozens of films, all these hours of film that he put on the screen, there's not one superfluous shot. But if Hitchcock put it on the screen for even a second, it had to be there. It was important for the story. It moved things along. It was integral to the story. It was informative. It wasn't just filler. No such thing as filler. So I said to the group at Gilda's Club, I said like this, can I say as much for God and the job he's doing making my story? Can I say as much for God and the job he's doing making my story as Truffaut said about Hitchcock and the job he did telling his stories? And I said, yeah, I think I could even say even more for God, you know, because like I just logically, I reasoned, I said, look, first of all, you know, God created Hitchcock. And then plus a bunch of other things, like, you know, he's got an unlimited budget. He's got no studio executives breathing down his neck. He's got a cast of billions, literally. He's got a fantastic art department. And some of the scenery is incredibly lifelike. So I said, yes, I believe that God could manage to show me a life, to show me a reality, where there was not one single fleeting moment that wasn't important for me. Sometimes it's pleasurable, sometimes it's painful. Sometimes I make a judgment that it's good, sometimes I make a judgment that it's bad. But the fact remains that God is doing a marvelous job showing me exactly what I need to see, and only what I need to see when I need to see it. And that I'm always right where I need to be, for now, for this second, right? Because next second, you know, you make another choice and you take another action and the situation changes. But always for now, like they taught you in grammar school about the verb tenses, present perfect, the present is always perfect for what it is. You know, and that's that attitude. It's corny as heck, but I don't care. I like it. Every moment is a gift. That's why it's called the present. Yeah. So right now, I'm always where I need to be. I'm always with the people I need to be with. Doing what I need to be doing for now, for this second. And that's because God is the author. And I'm really just, I'm the main character of my story. You're the main character of your story. You're the main character of your story. I'm the main character of my story. And I just show up for it. But the story is being perfectly told. So there's this lady in this group at Gilda's Club. And she looked so weak, frail. And all of a sudden she cries out. She says, "Rabbi!" And it was sort of like a disconnect for me because she looked so physically weak, but her voice was booming. I wasn't sure what it was, and I had made that condition with myself. If they tell me to shut up and go home, I'm going to follow their advice. So I said, "Yeah, what is it?" So she says, "My friends all think I'm crazy because we keep getting into these discussions. Don't you wish you never got sick?" And I say, "No, I don't wish I never got sick." "What? You're giving up?" "No, what are you talking about giving up? Every day I hope and I pray and I expect to beat this thing and live many long, healthy, happy years. Of course I'm going to beat it." "Oh, so you wish you never got it?" "No, I didn't say I never got it." So either they think I'm a dreikup, or it's some sort of semantic argument, or I lost my marbles, and they don't get it. They don't understand, and I don't have the words to articulate it till now. She says, "But now I know exactly what I need to explain to them. I don't wish I never got it, because to wish that I never got it means to wish for a different story. And this is my story. How do I know it's my story? Because I did get it, so that's my story. And I'm not willing to trade my story for another story in order to have an easier path. Of course, my view of the future is I outlive this thing. Of course. My view of the future is optimistic. But I look at the past and I say, this is my story. This is what got me here till now. So to change that is not just to change that detail. It's to change my story. It's to change my life." She says, "I don't want some other life. I want my life. The life that God is giving me." For me, that was one of the most powerful moments I had ever experienced of just the strength of the human spirit and the clarity of that idea. That life, and my story, the story that God is telling me, to me, about me. That is why a resentment is a disconnect from my true self and my true mission. And the healing for a resentment is to realign myself with my true self and my true mission. If I can embrace my story as a story, then I can also get rid of the resentment. Or, and I can say it conversely, when I get rid of the resentment, I can live my true story. I can be myself. The me that I'm supposed to be. Or like Shakespeare put it, "To thine own self be true." Let me try to illustrate this with an example. I'll tell you a story about this family. It's a Jewish family. They lived in Israel, actually. It was a large family. They had 12 sons in the family. And one of the boys, when he was a teenager, he was thrown in a pit and sold into slavery in Egypt. You know this family? Yeah? They made a Broadway musical about it. But originally it was based on a book, which I highly recommend. Okay, so Joseph and his brothers. Joseph is thrown in a pit, and he's sold into slavery, and all this stuff happens when he's 17 years old, and he doesn't see his father for all these decades, and it's a traumatic experience, a traumatic event. But in the end, you know, he becomes the viceroy of Egypt because he has this talent translating dreams, and he becomes promoted to run, basically, in effect, he's running the superpower, and Pharaoh is really just the figurehead. And then he gets reunited with his family, and they move to Egypt, and he sets them up in the land of Goshen, which is, you know, basically, like, you know, the valley is to LA, is like Goshen is to Egypt. That's what they tell me, at least. Okay. And he sets them up, you know, nice place. And then, and their father lives with them for a long time. And then the father passes away. Their father is Jacob. And then they bury Jacob in Israel. They take him back to Israel. And things were so good in Egypt that they go back to Egypt. There's no slavery. There's no oppression. There's no anti-Semitism. They go up to Israel for the funeral, and they go back to Egypt to continue living there. It's a good life. Except one thing. The brothers now are certain that now that their father's passed away, Joseph's finally going to take revenge for everything that they did to him. Basically, they ruined his life. So they come to him, and they make up this whole thing out of desperation. They say, oh, father said that you might be mad at us, and he said you shouldn't do anything. He never said it, such a thing. But they were worried. So Joseph realizes this, and he says to them, well, it's a verse in the Torah. In the last chapter of the whole book of Genesis, he says to them, I'll just tell you what he says. Am I instead of God? You meant it for bad, it turned out good. That's what he said to them. I'll say it again. Am I instead of God? You meant it for bad, it turned out good. This is an incredibly deep message. If we decode this sentence, there's a wealth of spiritual healing to be unlocked. Amazing message he shared. A cursorial reading, if we look at it superficially, oh, I know what Joseph said. He said, two wrongs don't make a right. No, that's not what he said. You know, that's basic kindergarten stuff. Two wrongs don't make a right. He said a lot more than that. But you have to unpack it. First of all, he said two things. Am I instead of God? That's the first thing. The second thing is, you meant it for bad, it turned out good. It's a lot of deep stuff here. Let me explain it to you. First of all, let's look at the second part. You meant it for bad, it turned out good. You're coming to me, and you're essentially apologizing for what? For ruining my life. Joseph's response? Don't flatter yourself. Oh, I get it. I understand your thinking, because... yeah, you're saying, I was 17, and like, yeah, that thing that you did, yeah, things kind of took a wild turn after that, right? Yeah, I understand. I wasn't exactly voted most likely to be thrown in a pit and sold into slavery of the senior class when I was 17 years old. I understand. That was kind of unexpected, right? We didn't see that coming. But I want to tell you something. You didn't see it coming, but that's my story. That's my story. And the fact you meant it for bad... okay, you meant it for bad, but it turned out good. It's still my story. Whatever your intention was is irrelevant. Because you think that your free will caused my life story to be derailed from God's plan? Oy vey. Oh, is that where we're going with this? No, I'm sorry. Created beings don't derail the will of the Creator. No, your free choice, yeah, that's a bad choice. Yeah, you made a bad choice, and you're going to have to do teshuva. You're going to have to repent. But that was the first thing I told you. Am I instead of God? You want to repent? I'm not the priest, and this is not confession. This is one of the most marvelously liberating things you will ever discover as an adult, that you do not have to be your victimizer's therapist. And they come to you to tell you what they did wrong. You can tell them, it's okay. Oh, you want to do teshuva? You want to repent because of the bad choices you made that happened to have been made against me? Okay, go do teshuva. Leave me out of the process. If you're sincere. See, anyone that we believe really derailed God's plan for our life, which essentially means we resent them, we idolize. We idolize those we resent. Do you know that? And I mean that literally. I'm not saying that figuratively. Because what is an idol? An idol is a created being to which we erroneously attribute uniquely godly attributes. Well, it's a uniquely godly attribute to write the story of my life. The moment I think any created being, whether it's a person or an institution or an event or a group of people, the moment I think that they somehow tore the steering wheel out of God's hands and derailed my life story, I am attributing to them the uniquely godly role of being the author of my life story. And I'm idolizing them. Funny, huh? You don't even like this person and you're idolizing them. Joseph didn't do that. He said, don't flatter yourself. Am I instead of God? You want to do teshuvah? You want to repent for your bad choices? Go talk to God. Everyone's entitled to turn over a new leaf and to grow spiritually. Even people who have victimized me. Yes, it's true. Even people who victimized me get to do teshuvah and they get to go, you know, grow and change and learn from it. Just, you know, don't involve me in it. I forgive you. You know, just move on. And as far as your God complex about derailing my life story, you meant it for bad. It turned out good. In other words, you're accountable for your bad choice. You're not accountable for the result. I know, it's a little late at night to be talking such deep philosophy right now. But those are two separate things. You're accountable for the bad choice. You're not accountable for the result. You understand the difference? I mean, this is deep stuff. This is philosophy here. You know, there was a yeshiva boy who needed to get married. And he had to meet a girl. Because to get married, you have to meet a girl. Traditionally speaking. And he asked his rabbi, he says, what should I talk to girls about? He says, girls like three subjects, food, family, and philosophy, the three F's. So he went out with the girl. I know how to spell philosophy, by the way. That's part of the joke. Okay. So he went out with the girl, and he says to her, okay, food. All right, food. Do you like fish? She's like, no. I don't like fish. He says, okay, family. Let me think, family. Oh, do you have a brother? She says, no, I don't have any brothers. He's thinking, oh, good, you know, I'm getting somewhere. Two out of the three. Okay, what's the third one? Philosophy, okay. So he says, philosophy. If you had a brother, do you think he would like fish? That's philosophy. Okay. So just philosophically speaking, that's deep stuff, huh? Philosophically speaking, someone does wrong, I do wrong, whoever does wrong, we are accountable for the bad choice. And what do you do when you've made a bad choice and you realize it? Well, you apologize, you make restoration, amends, and you do teshuva. You go to God, you talk about it, and you make things right. But you're doing teshuva because of the bad choice, not because of the outcome. The outcome was predetermined. The outcome was always going to happen. Well, if it was always going to happen, so why do I have to do teshuva? Why? Because why did you volunteer to be the messenger to get it done? That itself is a reason to do teshuvah. I know that he had to get thrown in a pit and sold into slavery. That was his script. That was going to happen to him. Why did I volunteer? I'll do it. And the thing is also, to compound it, you didn't know that was his script when you did it. You took it into your own hands. So Joseph had a really healthy way of separating those two things. The results... you didn't create those results. You didn't make anything happen. My story is the product of every single second. Really, the way we look at it from the perspective of Jewish mysticism, God didn't just create the world at one time, at some point, that the world is being created, recreated every single second, something from nothing. So it's really every single second, this dynamic creation that's coming into being out of non-existence. And God created everything, every detail of that circumstance, and all these things are just coming from God, straight from God, to me, about me, for me, my story. You're a player on the stage, yes, but you didn't make it happen. So, tip number one. Think more about God and less about people. Where's your story, where's your reality really coming from? That's tip number one. You're driving down the 405. Sitting there, whatever. Driving, sitting, alternately. And you're given ample time to just let your thoughts wander. And you're not really thinking about much of anything in particular. When you realize somehow that your throat is tight and your fists are clenched and your heart is pounding and you're breaking a sweat, what's happening? Your body's responding to some sort of stress, some sort of tension, and you realize that you're upset about something or someone from a year ago. Some of us can even do this about stuff from 10 years ago. I've seen people do it about stuff that's 70 or 80 years old. I'm not old enough to say I can do that yet, but I've seen people who can do it. They're having a response right now. They're feeling an emotion right now about some distress that is not happening in the here and now, and it happened long, long ago. That's what we call a resentment. And what's a resentment? A resentment is from the Latin root sentir, which means to feel, like sentiment or sentimental. So what's a resentment? A resentment's a resentiment. What's a resentiment? You're feeling it again. It's not happening now, but you're feeling it again now. Now that's a marvelous thing. That's a bargain. You get hurt one time 10 years ago, and you can extract a lifetime of suffering from that. That's a bargain. I mean, if you're into suffering, I'm saying. What the heck is that? Why does that happen? You know why it happens? You're meditating. You're meditating. If you know how to have a resentment, you know how to meditate. Because what's a meditation? Taking an abstract concept, something that's not concrete in the here and now, and thinking about it intently and focusing your thoughts on it until you have an emotional reaction. Well, that's what a resentment is. It's not happening now, but you're feeling it now. It doesn't exist in this world. It exists in one place, in your memory of it. And yet that memory of it that you're playing through your head is actually causing you to respond with the physiological signs of distress. You can have adrenaline rushing, and there's no threat in your environment. It's an amazing thing. Only human beings can do that. Think about that. That's the difference, by the way, between pain and suffering. Pain is useful. Suffering is self-inflicted torture. Right? Because what's pain? Whether it's physical pain or emotional pain. Pain is like a survival mechanism. It's that sign that your body is giving you that says, whoa, back off. This is not a safe place. So whether it's physical pain and physical danger or emotional pain and emotional danger. But the pain is useful. The pain is back off. Get out of here. Protect yourself. What's the suffering, though? The suffering is the analysis of the pain. It's the sort of the victim role that you assign to yourself based on the pain. It's sort of the, you know, woe is me attitude. The pain only lasts as long as is necessary to get you into safety, right? The survival mechanism is over, though, once you're out of, you know, once the stimulus is over. It's over. The pain is over. But the suffering can go on for a lifetime because it's self-inflicted. Anyway, anytime you want to conjure it up. I think this is a little abstract. Let me explain it to you. Let me illustrate it for you. You get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to get a drink of water from the kitchen. And you're walking across the kitchen floor. And if you have little kids, let's say, but have you ever stepped on a Lego? Okay. All right. So you know. All right. I don't wish it upon anyone. Okay. By the time we're done tonight, you will not even wish that your worst enemy should ever step on a Lego. Okay, so you're walking across the kitchen floor, and you step on a Lego. And you say, ow! That's pain. You sit down, you bury your face in your hands, and you say, why does stuff like this always happen to me? That's suffering. The pain was a physiological, biological, neurological, whatever. It's a response. There's nothing neurotic about pain. Like we say in Yiddish, asatut ve'ishreitmen. If it hurts, okay, it hurts. But a second later, okay, so you're not stepping on the Lego anymore. You're sitting there brooding about it. That's the suffering. And that can go on forever and ever and ever. So you're sitting there on the 405 and you're thinking about the person who ruined summer camp between 5th and 6th grade. Oh, you know who I'm talking about. Okay. And it's not happening now. Nothing's happening now. There's absolutely no pain. There's no survival mechanism response to anything, any stimulus that I need to get away from to get either physically or emotionally safe. There's just self-inflicted torture coming from my brain. And that's called a bad meditation. The resentment's a bad meditation. So what's a good meditation? What would you tell an intelligent 5-year-old Jewish child who asked you, where is God? It's a good group. Okay, you'd say God is everywhere, which is just simple plain English for God is omnipresent. That's theological talk. Omnipresent, that's the theological, you know, expression. I spoke about philosophy before. Did I speak about theology? By the way, I can't even remember what jokes I told a year ago when I was here. But anyways, so regarding theology, they say, by the way, a joke you can repeat once every other year, and a story once every year, a Dvar Torah twice in the same speech. Okay. There was once a medieval town in Europe, and the local bishop told the Jews they got to get out. Unless the Jews can beat him in a theological debate. So there was a simple Jew, his name was Meishele. He came to the rabbis. He said, let me do it. I'll debate the bishop. They said, Meishele, you're illiterate. I mean, you're going to debate? He says, don't worry. If I lose, then we'll say, well, what do you expect? It was just Meishele. If we win, it'll be a big coup. So Meishele gets up there and they say, oh, by the way, the bishop made a condition. The debate is in sign language. Pantomimes. So they get up on the stage, and the bishop goes like this. Meishele looks at him, he goes like this. The bishop goes like this. Meishele goes like this. The bishop takes out communion, wine, and wafers. Meishele takes out an apple. The bishop says, that's it, this man's a theological genius, I quit. Half an hour later, at the bishop's manor, the bishop's guys are asking him, would his excellency please explain to us what transpired in the debate with the Jew? The bishop says like this, look, this man was a genius. Every point I said, he countered me. I couldn't get anywhere with him. What? Tell us what? Okay, first of all, I said to him the Trinity. He looks back at me and says, but we both believe in one God. I said, I'm going to scatter you guys. He says, we're staying right here. I took out the communion wine and wafer to symbolize the expiation of sin. He took out the apple to remind me of original sin. I couldn't debate him. The man was a genius. That's it. Back in the Jewish section of town, the rabbis are saying, Moshele, what happened? We didn't follow your debate with the bishop. So he says, look, it's very simple. He says, you guys have 3 days to get out of town. I said, not one of us is leaving. He says, I'm going to scatter you. I said, we're staying right here. And that was it. They said, no, but what was that part at the end? He says, that, I have no idea. He took out his lunch, so I took out mine. Okay, so that's theology. So what were we talking about theology? What was the idea? The theological concept we were talking about? Who remembers? What? Oh, omnipresent, right. So you talk to a 5-year-old child and he says, where's God? And you tell him God's omnipresent. You say, God is everywhere. What's a song? You know, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Everyone knows the song?
Yes.
Okay, God in Israel is doing a good job then. Okay. All right. Remember, by the way, register your kids for camp. It's not too early, right? All right. So Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Great. So we all know this concept. We all know that God is everywhere. Excellent, excellent. We all pass Jewish kindergarten. All right, now, here's my question. How do you feel about that? Not that you passed Jewish kindergarten. How do you feel about this concept? See, there's one thing to know it. To know it. It's a piece of information. You know it. You get it right on the test. Do you know that God is omnipresent? Yes, I do. Okay, congratulations. You get credit. That's one thing. You know it. But then there's processing it until you come out with an emotion. Okay, like you ever get together with your friends and like, okay, what do you want? Pizza or Chinese? What do you, come on, what's taking you? I got to think. What do you mean you got to think? Pizza or Chinese? I'm thinking. What do you, I'm not telling you to figure out what I like. I'm telling you, well, what do you like? You don't know what you like? What do you need time to think? It's what you like. Just tell me what you like. But you know the funny thing is, we really do sometimes need a few minutes to think. What's happening in those few minutes when we're thinking pizza or Chinese? You don't know what you want? And I'll explain it to you. You tell me if you relate to this, because this is what happens when I do it. I'm not thinking in order to figure out what I want. If I wanted it, I would know. I'm thinking in order to want. You see, I have a piece of information in my brain. I know what the experience of eating Chinese food is. Intellectually. I have another piece of information in my brain. I know what the experience of eating pizza is, intellectually. But in order to have an emotion about it, I've got to run it through my thought. There's a difference between having a piece of information stored on the hard drive and actually running that software, opening that application. I'll give you an example. Okay? You know the times? Yeah, you. You know. By the way, I know. What's your name again?
Ari,
that's right. Okay, we met Shabbos in Encino. Okay. We should catch up later, but not right now because it'd be rude to everyone else. Anyways, so Ari, you know the times tables?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So let's start from a high number, like 7. Like 7 times 3 is 21. 7 times 4 is 28. 7 times 5 is 35. Okay, can you do it in your head, though? Not verbally. Don't articulate. Just do it in your brain, in your head. Starting from 7 times 4. Okay, do it silently in your head. Okay. All right, fine. Ari is doing the times tables in his head right now. All right, you're doing it right now? Okay, fine. Here's my question to you. Were you doing it 5 minutes ago?
No.
No. Did you know it 5 minutes ago? Yeah, you've probably known it for quite some years. Okay. So that's the difference between what you know and what you're thinking. You've known the times tables for many years, but you weren't thinking it until just a moment ago when I asked you to do so. In other words, I can have a piece of information in my brain. In other words, I had an experience. I learned something from life, you know? You know about the two guys, by the way, who made a partnership because one had money and one had experience? By the time they were done, the one with the experience got the money, and the one who used to have some money got some experience. So you had an experience in life. You learned something. That's a piece of information that you store in your head. Or you got it from a book, a fact, whatever it is. A Wikipedia article you read. Okay? Or Hashem is everywhere. Whatever it is. These are all intellectual bits that we keep in our head. They don't form emotions unless we think them. Unless we run them through thought. Knowledge and thought are two separate things. In the Holy Tongue, one is called seichel, which has been adopted in Yiddish, like, right? Like, use some seichel. Seichel means intellect. But then there's machshava, which is the actual thought. Which, by the way, reveals to us a very interesting thing about human nature. Why there could be a person who thinks a lot, but doesn't have a lot of seichel. You ever realize that? Just like there could be somebody who speaks a lot, but it's not really saying anything. You could be thinking a lot, and there's not a lot of intelligence behind it. Overthinking. Overanalyzing, and there's not a lot of seichel, there's not a lot of intellect behind it. Or reverse, you could have someone with an amazing intellect, they were never taught how to think. So it's untapped, it's undeveloped. We only get an emotional reaction about the stuff that we think about, and that's why the resentment is such an important and powerful... To know what a resentment is important and powerful. It's the re-sentiment, the re-feeling. There's only one way I can re-feel it. I have a lot of pieces of information in my brain right now that I'm not emotionally reacting to. I couldn't possibly. I'm emotionally reacting to the pieces of information in my brain which I'm giving the outlet of thought. Now, I can allow myself to be at the whim of my stream of consciousness And if I start thinking about the person who ruined my summer camp between 5th and 6th grade, then what can I do? That's what we're going to be meditating on this afternoon. Well, what can I do? It popped in my head. You know, I got no choice. Or I could be proactive about the kind of stuff that I run in my head. And I could say like this. Look, there's a basic concept. God is everywhere. Great. Interesting piece of information. But what is it worth to me if I never thought about it until I produced an emotion? Meditation. The Hasidic term for it is hisbonanus. Bina, using elaborative thought. You take one kernel of knowledge and you elaborate upon it with all sorts of examples and metaphors and stories and put it in your own words. It's very important to put it in your own words. You got to put it in your own words. You know about Chelm? Yeah? Chelm was famous for the foolish people who thought they were wise. There one time the Shamish, the custodian of the shul in Chelm, went to the big city. He went to Warsaw. So he came into the shul in Warsaw, and the Shamish of Warsaw says, I'm going to have some fun. He goes over to the Shamish of Chelm. He says to him, oh, you're from Chelm. I hear the people there are very wise. Could I ask you a riddle? He says, sure, lay it on me. He says, okay, here's the riddle. I'm my father's son, but I'm not my brother. Who am I? Shamish of Chelm says, wow, that is a good riddle. I must be tired from traveling. I can't think of the answer. Just tell it to me. Shamash Warsaw says, come on, think about it. I'm my father's son, but I'm not my brother. I'm me. Myself. Ah, of course. Shamash Chelm runs back to Chelm. He runs into the shul. He goes to the east side of the synagogue where the wise men sit. And he says, wise men, I have a riddle. They say, lay it on us. We are good at riddles. He says, okay, I am my father's son, but I'm not my brother. Who am I? We must be having a bad day. We would usually answer this so quickly we can't figure it out. Lay it on us. What's the answer? He says, come on, guys, think about it. I'm my father's son, but I'm not my brother. I am the Shamash of Warsaw. So why'd you ruin the story? How'd you ruin it? He said it the way he heard it, right? He didn't make it about himself. He didn't internalize it. Right? That's the difference between someone who says, you know, you ask him, what's your moral opinion on such and such an event? He says, well, the Torah says... Well, that's great if the Torah says that. That's nice information. But I was asking you. And hopefully, if you study Torah and you internalize it, your opinion will match the Torah. But I asked you. So you don't have to tell me the Torah says. You don't have to tell me the quote. I don't want to hear something in quotation marks. I want to hear what you say. I used to live in this town where there was a daycare center called He Cares Daycare. It was a religious place, not a Jewish place, like a Christian daycare, called He Cares Daycare. And it always bothered me every time I drove by, and I couldn't understand why. Why is it bothering me? He Cares Daycare. Like, these are faith-based people. That's great. They believe in God. That's beautiful. It's a beautiful message. He cares. And yet, it bothered me so much. You know why? I had to actually play it out in my head. I pretended actually, like, talking to these people and asking them, like, so are you taking good care of the children? He cares. What? I don't want to know he cares. Do you care? I know he cares. Do you care? This is personal. This is about me. So it could be this academic knowledge. Yeah, God is everywhere. Okay. But how does that resonate in your personal experience? Tell me stories, examples, anecdotes that convey that concept in an emotional way, in an experiential way. In a personal way. You know, we could be geniuses in the truth, and it's not going to help us one bit in being emotionally healthy. And the only bridge to get from that abstract knowledge to that emotional, you know, that real healthy response, just like we have that gut response to the negative toxic thoughts, and we're feeling it, and we're getting, you know, the adrenaline's pumping, and we can also have the physiological response, that real serenity, and that calm, and that joy. We can have the positive response in our gut to the good knowledge, but the bridge between the knowledge and the emotional response is the thought, and it's what you think about that determines all that. So we got to stop meditating on our enemies and the people that we're falsely attributing to godlike powers of running our lives. We got to start meditating on the one who really runs our lives. And it's not hard. We're doing it already. We're doing it already, just about the wrong people. It's a question a lot of people ask about this. They say, look, if I'm going to start to embrace my life story, I'm going to start realizing that my victimizers, they may have to do teshuva for what they've done, but really they haven't changed my life one bit. I'm worried about one thing. I'm just concerned about one thing. And I've heard this question many times. I'm concerned about one thing. See, I'm concerned that if I lose the anger... You're laughing already. I also laugh at this, but not to anyone's face. If I lose the anger, I'll get hurt again. It's a concern that the anger is protecting me. One of the most spiritually healthy stories I ever heard somebody tell about themselves. I was sitting in a group of people, friends and families of alcoholics, and this guy was talking about his 90-year-old mother who's dying in a nursing home, and he refuses to visit her because she's evil. And he says, and you guys are going to tell me that the anger is useless, but I got to be angry at her. Otherwise, I'm saying everything she did was okay. So nobody tried to talk him out of it, but then this one lady was speaking, and she didn't say anything to him. She just spoke about herself. She started telling her story, and she was saying that she used to be married to this guy who would come home any time between, you know, 5 p.m. if he came straight home from work, or 5 a.m. You know, you never really knew which, you know, point in that 12-hour window it would be. So, you know, when he would come in, stumbling in, drunk in the middle of the night, she had this thing that she would sleep on the couch. And when he would come in the door, she would grab the lamp or the ashtray or the clock or whatever was within reach and throw it at his head. And that was their ritual, basically, for many years. Okay. So she said one night, it was 10 p.m., she remembers very, very lucidly it being 10 p.m. on the digital clock. She says, I remember looking at the 10 o'clock, and it was almost like a voice in my head. But it was like this resounding clarity, and it told me, just this deep epiphany, which was, I think normal people go to bed at 10 o'clock. And there was this brief thought of, but I can't go to bed now. I stay on the couch with a lamp or an ashtray or a clock within hand's reach so I can throw it at my drunk husband's head whenever he will stumble in. And then the voice came back and said, normal people go to bed at 10 o'clock. So she said, I went to the door and I turned the bolt, and I locked the chain, and I went upstairs, and I got into my pajamas, and I got in bed, and I never slept so soundly before in my entire life. She said that was like her spiritual awakening. So the guy with the 90-year-old mother and the resentment, he says, you know, it's very holier than thou, your whole story. Pretending how you rose above the anger. But I actually spotted it. You revealed yourself. You locked the door with the chain. She says, you know, that's funny because I haven't been married to this guy now for 20 years, and I still lock the door every night with the chain. What's she saying? Normal people doing normal things. When someone around us is acting insanely, and we sort of counter that insanity, we volley it back to them. Oh, you threw a little craziness my way? Pop, here's a little craziness back, right? And we start to adjust We start to actually become part of the cycle of craziness, and it becomes unclear who started it or who's even being crazy anymore, or is this crazy? You know, my Zaidi told me, all of a sudden, my Zaidi told me about the guy who picked up the suit on the way to the chasana. He was running off to a wedding. Mamish a few minutes before the wedding, and he runs into the tailor. He says, "Give me the suit real quick. I got to go to the wedding." Taylor says, "Here it is, go put it on." He comes out of the dressing room and he says to the tailor, "You ruined me." He says, "How did I ruin you?" He says, "I'm going to the wedding right now. There's no time to fix anything. The sleeve is too long." So he says, "That's not a problem. You go like this and it takes up the extra fabric and it looks fine." He says, "The pant leg is too short." He says, "So bend your knee like this and it'll look okay." He says, "The back is longer than the front." He says, "So you go like this and it looks okay." He says, "The shoulder's baggy." He says, "Go like that." The guy says, "I don't have time to argue with them. I'm going to the wedding." So he's walking down the street, heading to the wedding hall. And two ladies pass by. And one of them says, "Oh my goodness, look at that crippled man." And the other one says, "Yes, but his tailor must be a genius." So you adjust. You adjust for craziness until you don't know that your adjustments themselves are crazy. It's 10 o'clock. Normal people go to bed. Lock the door with the bolt, with the chain. Oh, but he's still drunk and hasn't called? So I should do something abnormal to adjust for that? That's crazy. Compound craziness with craziness? There is no boundary that we can put up for ourselves that will not be more effectively put up if we do it with zero anger. The anger is the volleying back the craziness. "You're going to get crazy on me, I'll get twice as crazy on you." How about put up a boundary? How about behave in a normal way, irregardless of the other person's behavior? And for doing that, you don't have to be angry at all. You don't have to be angry. There's no boundary that you can effectively put up with zero anger that you would be able to do it any better with anger. And to the contrary, you'll do it better without the anger. You'll make better decisions, you'll have better clarity without the anger. Sages tell us that worshiping that anger is like worshiping idols. You know that? Talmud says, getting angry is like worshiping idols. I don't normally mention that in speeches because it makes people angry. But that's a serious thing. And what do the sages mean by that? Are they just trying to... Thank you, Avi. Are they just trying to make an impression on us, like hysterical parents who like tell you, "Oh, that toy is dangerous." How dangerous? "Oh, it'll poke your eye out," right? Always looking for something dramatic. The sages are saying, "Oh, don't get angry." "Oh, how bad is anger? Like worshiping idols bad?" "Yeah, that bad. Don't do it." Okay. Why is getting angry like worshiping idols? Because again, it's a rejection of the author. My reality happens in a certain way, and I say, it's not supposed to be that way. How do you know? You know the best evidence that your life is supposed to be the way it is? It's because that's how it is. The anger is the rejection of the reality. Rejection of reality is rejection of the author of reality. That is idolatry. And I'm not saying this from a theological perspective even. It's like, I'm not even like trying to save you from the great sin of idolatry here. I'm actually just saying, push it on a mental health level. Why torture yourself? Rabbi Gordon told me I said this joke twice now already. So I know consciously that I'm saying a joke for the third time in the valley. And I'm going to do it anyways, because he stepped out of the room for a second. My father's a psychologist. That's not the setup for the joke, by the way. That's true. Okay. And one time he said to me, when I was like 14 years old, he says, "What's the difference between psychosis and neurosis?" So I said, "I don't know. What's the difference between psychosis and neurosis?" He says, "Psychosis is when you think 2 plus 2 equals 5. Neurosis is you know 2 plus 2 equals 4 and you can't stand it." Okay, I got away with that. All right. Reality is a holy thing in Judaism. There's no coincidences. There's no accidents. Reality is a holy thing. God is creating the reality every single second, something from nothing. For me, to me, about me. And I am obligated to say that the world is created for my sake. I mean, each one of us say that about our own realities, our own lives. And the anger, the worry, the dread, the resentment, the fear, all these reality-rejecting emotions, they make us sick, and they tune us out from the author of reality. They disconnect us from God. So the first tip was to embrace my story. This is my story. Second tip is keep meditating like you've been doing, but just meditate on the real author of your story, not on these characters. Third tip was any boundary you can put up successfully without anger, the anger is not going to help you. You can do it much better without the anger. What's another tip? Well, I'll tell you another thing. Oftentimes people will say to me, they'll say, you know what? I got another concern. My concern is, okay, I hear you, but here's my concern. If I'm going to get so accepting of my reality, I will become apathetic. I'll become apathetic to suffering. And I don't want that. I want to be an activist. I want that when I know that somebody is hurting, that it should hurt me and I should want to do something about it. That's a good point. But I'll tell you my answer to that. The other day we got a delivery from UPS. It was a box from Best Buy. And the UPS guy said, your neighbor's not home. Could you sign for this? I said, yeah, sure. And the UPS guy left. I brought the Best Buy box in my house. It looked like something nice, like a big flat screen TV. And I was thinking, you know, he brought it to my house. Maybe we can keep this. No. He brought it to me. I signed for it. Let me keep it. Anyone has any objection to that? Okay, so we all know it's wrong, but it's not just wrong, it's absurd. Why is it absurd? We all know it's absurd because it's not addressed to you. It doesn't have your name on it. It doesn't have your address on it. You can't accept somebody else. I mean, I can hold on to it for him till he comes, but I can't take ownership of it. It's not mine to accept. So it's an absurd concept, not just immoral, absurd to say I'm going to accept it. I think it's very, very important that the terminology that the sages use in Talmud to describe equanimity, you know, that ability to go even keel through life, even in the face of suffering, even in the face of adversity. The term that the sages use for that is to be mikabel yisurim be'ahava, to receive or to accept pain with love. I think it's very, very important. It's no small detail to be mikabel, to receive or to accept pain with love. The word receive or accept is key here. I can't accept a delivery that wasn't sent to me. I can accept a delivery that is sent to me. I can't accept a delivery that's not sent to me. So therefore, if God chooses And I hope he doesn't, because I pray every morning. It's in the prayer book. I ask him not to test me on a daily basis. But let's say God chooses that I need a test. And he's going to send me some hardship or some adversity in life. God, I'm just saying this very theoretically. Don't do this. Okay. If he so chooses that that's what I got to go through, I can and will accept it. He sent it to me. All right. Then I embrace it. And I might scream, oy vey, this hurts. Okay, pain is pain. But I'm not going to brood about it. I'm not going to reject it. I'm not going to get angry, fearful, worried, resentful, all those reality-rejecting emotions. I'm going to accept it. But if God sends you a peckle tzoris, little package of hardship, I can't stand up and say, oh, I'll accept that on his behalf. I accept it. It's okay that he's going through hell. In fact, I'll even give him a theological explanation for why he's going through hell. Don't you love when people do that? By the way, did you know that's forbidden according to Jewish law? Forbidden? Yeah, in the book of Job, his friends come to comfort him when he's going through his difficulties. And instead of just comforting him, they all decide to get philosophical and they start giving him explanations for why he's going through what he's going through. And the Talmud discusses how wrong that was. And it actually brought in Shulchan Aruch and the code of Jewish law. It's a law. And you know, like, don't mix milk and meat. Okay, this is part of Jewish law. It says if you see somebody else going through a difficult experience, you're not allowed to say to him, oh, you know why you're going through that? I've come up with a theological explanation for why you're being punished. You're forbidden. You're not allowed to say that. On the other hand, if somebody sees himself going through a terrible time in life, you know what the advice of the sages is? Mefashfish b'maisov. Scrutinize your deeds. Hold on a second. This guy over here, bad stuff is happening to him, and I'm not allowed to accept it. I'm supposed to cry out to God. I'm going through a hard time, and I'm supposed to not only accept it, I'm supposed to figure out what my part is. How can they both be true? You know how they're both true? One's about him, one's about me. Two different things. Mel Brooks sort of said this, except actually he was being humorous, so he flipped it on its head and said it like the exact 180 degree inverse, upside down phrasing. Mel Brooks said, they asked him about, Mel, what's comedy? He says, you know what comedy? You have to understand comedy as compared to tragedy. See, tragedy is when I get a paper cut. Comedy is when that guy falls down a manhole and dies. That was Mel's idea of a joke. The truth is, comedy is anything that happens to me. Comedy is anything that happens to me. I can laugh at myself. But God help me if I'm going to laugh at you when you're down. That's a tragedy. And being Jewish is having both of those. So the same Abraham that God said to him, oh, you're 75 years old and you're ready to retire? Not so fast. Get up. You're going to a new land. And I'll let you know when you get there. That same Abraham who was ready to roll with it, whatever wild idea God said, oh, this is time for this, time for that. And he just rolled with it. Anything that was about him, he did it. And then God says, oh, and by the way, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. What? You can't do it. Because one's about me, one's about the other guy. I accept the hardships that are sent to me. But the hardships that are sent to the other guy? No, the Jewish response is, God, how could you do it? And what can I do to ease the suffering of somebody else? And I look, how can I tangibly aid them? What can I do? Money, time, support, love, what? So they're two totally different worlds. All right, so let's go through the tips again. One, embrace your life story. Two, stop thinking about people. Start thinking about God. Three, put up good boundaries, and any boundary you can successfully put up without anger, I just rephrase that. Any boundary you can put up with anger, you can do it even better without the anger. And the fourth thing is, when it's sent to you, you know, like they say, if God brings you to it, he can bring you through it. Or like Winston Churchill said, if you're going through hell, keep going. Right? So if it's sent to me, I embrace it, I roll with it. If it's sent to you, I cry out, I have compassion. And they're both true. All right. So I want to tell you a quick story from the Zohar. Zohar is like the canonical text of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism. And it tells a story there about Reb Abba. Reb Abba was the scribe of Reb Shimon. The Zohar was authored by Reb Shimon ben Yochai, who was the Mishnaic sage, lived in the Holy Land during the Roman times, and his scribe was Reb Abba. He used to write down everything that Reb Shimon used to teach. So one time Reb Abba came to the town of Lod, and he was resting on the edge of the town by the highway, you know, like the freeway on-ramp, sort of. And he saw another traveler sit down on a rock. And the traveler sort of nodded off. And as this traveler is sleeping, this poisonous snake slithered up to him and was about to bite him and kill him. And before Reb Abba could even say anything, a little rodent came by and snapped the head off of the poisonous snake. And Reb Abba thinks, this guy almost got killed. He doesn't know how close he came. Wow, it's amazing. After a little while, the guy wakes up from his nap and he stands up from the rock, and the rock tumbles off the edge of a cliff that he didn't realize he was sitting next to. So Reb Abba says, wow, he doesn't know how close he just came. Reb Abba runs over to the stranger and he says, sir, tell me what you do. He says, what do you mean, what do I do? He says, what special zchus, what special merit do you have? You have something that you do. He says, no, not really, I'm a regular guy. He says, it's not true. I saw just two times a miracle in rapid succession happen on your behalf. There's something going on that you're doing, some sort of pious practice. He says, I really don't know what it could be. But Reb Abba wasn't letting the guy go, so he kept thinking and thinking and thinking. So finally he says, okay, you know what, maybe it is. I don't know if this is it, but maybe it is. I have a thing that I do. Every night, before I go to bed, I won't go to sleep until I review my day. And when I review my day, I think, is there anyone I had, you know, quarrel with? Or anyone had quarrel with me? And I won't go to bed until I've appeased that person. And if I can't appease them, then I forgive them in my heart. By the way, you get that. If I can't appease them, then I forgive them. Not that they have to forgive me. I forgive them. And I don't go to bed until that's sorted out. So Reb Abba says, Rabbeinu Shalala, Master of the Universe, look at the greatness of this man. He is greater than Joseph. Joseph forgave his brothers. And this man forgives all people. And since then, that prayer of this simple Jew, who we don't even know who he was recorded and transmitted to us to this day. We have it in many of our prayer books. If you pray from the prayer book that's used here in this congregation, the Tilas Hashem Sidur, in the bedtime Shema. So it's the first paragraph of the bedtime Shema. It says, Master of the Universe, I hereby forgive anyone who has sinned against me. Whether my person or my property or my honor. That's the prayer that we get from this encounter that Reb Abba had. This is an incredibly powerful spiritual tool to have in your spiritual toolkit. If you're looking for a new mitzvah, a new practice to engage in, or looking for something that maybe you've done before and you need to re-enliven it, the bedtime Shema with that paragraph that you don't go to bed until you cleared the slate. Because I got to tell you something, life is a spiritual journey, and it's a journey that's best traveled lightly, without baggage, without encumbrance. And the resentments are what ties us down. Remember, every time we have a resentment and we relive that pain and we suffer, you know, we do that toxic meditation, that self-inflicted torture of suffering. Okay, we attribute godlike power to a created being. We divorce ourselves from the real godlike power in our lives. And we deny our story. We deny our true story, our true self. So it'll be a good thing every single night to say that prayer. And I got to tell you something. It's okay if the same person in the same offense pops up more than one night. It might take a few nights, a few hundred nights, whatever it takes. But you got to get these people off the list. They say Nixon used to have a list of enemies. I don't know why they say it about him. I thought that was like a normal thing. Everyone has a list of enemies, right? So one of the metrics for how spiritually developed you are, like how well you're coming along in life, is if your list is shrinking. See, sometimes people think you go through life, the older you get, the longer your list of people you hate. Should be the opposite. Your list should be getting shorter and shorter. This guy walks into a doctor's office. He says, I'm a moth. Doctor says, you realize I'm a dentist, don't you? He says, yeah, I know that. Dentist says, so why'd you come in here? The moth guy says, because your light was on. It's very, very important to identify if you're playing a script. It's just, it's not the real you. You can get hurt one time. And sometimes, you know, the people who hurt us, the people who are really close to us, and they weren't supposed to hurt us. And they hurt us in ways that really cut deep. But when we define ourselves according to those injustices, or even perceived injustices, and we get that victim script, you know, and we don't live our lives. So I want to encourage all of us here, and it's something that constantly needs maintenance, to get back in touch with our true story, to get back in touch with our true self, our soul's mission, by remembering all along that there has always only been one author who has all power. He's all powerful and he's all loving. And hasn't shown us even one superfluous shot. It's all been meaningful, every second of it, right until this very moment that we're all sitting here right now. So now we all know it, intellectually. Got to keep thinking about it. Bring it down emotionally. When we do, it's quite a life. Happy, joyous, and free. That's what we wish upon all of us here, and ultimately, yes, even on those people that we thought ruined our lives. They should also be happy, joyous, and free. Any questions, comments, arguments? No? Yeah? Yes.
And the state that we have to accept our story, but even in the Torah, like Moshe, he didn't want to go down to Egypt, so he questioned his story in a way. And we have many examples of the question for what happened, you know?
Well, right, because exactly. So that's why is someone else being treated this way? when Moshe said, why are you hurting these people, the Jewish people? So it's about somebody else. I can't accept it on their behalf, so I have to object to it, and I have to ask how I can help. Oh, that's a different question. That's a good question. Okay, that's a good question. I didn't touch upon that. All right, so here's basically how to get clarity on that. I'll tell you something. I am very, very bad at distinguishing between what I want and what I need. Because every time I will ask myself, do you really need that or do you just want that? I am really, really good at convincing myself that things that I want, I really need. Yeah. You know why? Because my Yetzer Hara uses my brain, so he's just as smart as me. So I will get zero clarity asking that question. You know what question will help me better? If I ask, do you need this? I'm always going to say, yeah, I need it, even if I just want it. So I don't say, do you need it or do you want it? I say, do you need it? Or is this something you are needed for? And that gets me clarity. And life is a lot different that way. If I show up in a room, let's say, trying to get my needs met, I always get hurt. But if I show up in a room trying to be needed or meet needs, usually goes pretty well. It's pretty smooth. By the way, what's the biggest sign that you really just want to be needed? When you show up and you look around and you see everything's fine and you say, oh, thank God nobody needs anything. Because if you walk in the room and nobody needs anything, you say, what? Nobody needs anything? Well, what am I going to do? Oh, let me go make that guy cry and then I'll comfort him. Right? Then that's not, you're not really being needed. You need something. You need to be needed, which again is being needy. No. Truly not being needy means walk in the room. If everything's fine, Baruch Hashem, nobody needs anything, beautiful. If somebody does need something, oh, let me see how I can be of help, be of service. So I try to focus on my being of service. That gets me out of self-pity. It also opens me up to interactions with other human beings. It also opens me up to my true mission in life, which is what it's all about. So I think for somebody like Moshe Rabbeinu to say to God, to question, is this, am I really needed for this? Okay? There's a certain truth to that. Like, I don't need the glory. And I don't need the trouble. I don't need either. Am I needed? Now, I'm not on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, so I'm not really fit for those kinds of discussions with God. So I'll tell you on my level how those discussions take place. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll say to God, there's a situation that I'm looking at and I'm thinking of butting in and I'm not sure I'm really needed. You know, is this some sick need on my part to be validated by being the one who helped? Or is this really my mission? Is this really where I'm needed? And what I try to do is I try to look at it from a completely selfless perspective, objectively, and I think to myself, if I will never get any credit for this, if I will never get any recognition, if the person who I'm helping won't even like me better because of it, and I do it, will it still be objectively helpful to that person? And the answer is yes. I go and I do it. And I think that's a healthy thing. I think that's a healthy thing to get really good at doing good without getting caught. Right? Because a lot of us, we do good, but we want to make sure it's noticed. Right? And sometimes it's this passive-aggressive shtick, like, you know, you ever had somebody do something lovingly for you, and then the next day there was this invisible invoice that arrived in the mail, which you didn't see? You didn't know you were invoiced for their love until a couple days later they blow up at you and say, didn't you know you owed me one? Didn't you know one taking out the trash without being asked is worth one? Oh, honey, you're so great. You don't know the currency in this family. How could you do that? So, again, it's important for me to focus on where am I needed, okay? Where am I doing good without expectation of reward or validation? And that's a worthwhile question to ask, and one that requires sometimes meditation. You see somebody, you know, crying out for help, drowning in the river. That's a no-brainer. Sometimes it's a lot harder to figure it out. And that's why we need a lot of quiet time, and we need to think about God, and we need to, in our daily meditation, really ask God, how can I be helpful? Not how can I be helped. How can I be helpful? Yeah. So there was a question here. Yes.
Without their appreciation, you know, that you're doing it out of the kindness of your heart. But at the same time, you're actually directing them down.
Ooh.
It's really the way of, you know, you being helpful to that person. You're putting out your own family. You're disregarding your own family. You're hurting your children. You're taking away from your children.
Yeah. Everyone hear the question? Oh. I'm sighing not because it's a hard question. I'm sighing because it's a painful situation. It's a very simple question with a very simple answer. And you know the answer, which is you got to cut it out. There's very few things that I know for sure about my mission, about my way of being most useful to God. But one of the things I do know, and I try to study from Hashgacha Pratis, from Divine Providence, right? You try to use reality as a cue, you know, that God sort of hints to you where your path is by bringing you along that path, right? So oftentimes we think we need to run across the world to be helpful in some far off land, and really God is saying, no, I put you in a situation, open your eyes, this is where you're needed, right? Okay, one of those cues, which is really, really clear, is who is my spouse and who are my children? And the principle that charity begins at home. So my first obligation is to, before my family, myself. First is to myself. And by to myself, by the way, again, I don't mean self-indulgently, I mean my mission. Okay, if there's anything that impinges upon my ability to be useful, to be of service to God and to His children, then I got to cut it out of my life, even if it's something that I like. Even if it's something that I'm comfortable with, then I got to cut it out of my life. That's number one. Then I got to look, is this something that's getting in the way of being of service, being useful to my spouse and to my children? And if it is, I got to cut it out, even if it's something that I like. And I have to radiate outward in concentric circles like that. I'm absolutely sure that nobody's life mission is to go away from the people that God put closest to you in order to be of service. There are plenty of opportunities to be of service in your own home. To me, probably the best story for conveying that. There's this guy. One time I heard him speaking. His name is Jim. He's not Jewish. Jim's got like 20 years sober in AA. And he talks about the idea of, you know, being of service. That's one of the steps. It's the 12th step, actually. That's really like the long-term maintenance of sobriety is being of service. Not being selfish, but being selfless. Being of service. You have to be of service to remain spiritually fit, and you have to remain spiritually fit in order to remain sober. So Jim tells the story about he went through all the steps and had a spiritual awakening in 6 months. And at the end of it, he got his sobriety and he got his sanity and he got his serenity. And his wife was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And he's just got this brand new gift of sobriety. And he says, for a year and a half, I didn't go to any meetings. I didn't work with any drunks. Because I was at home for a year and a half with a dying wife and a little kid at home. And some people told me, they said, Jim, you got to be of service. You got to go to a meeting and find a newcomer. Or you're going to lose your precious gift of sobriety. He said, the people that talked that way to me were people who hadn't been through the steps, so I knew not to listen to them. I had done the steps, and I had begun a personal relationship with God. And it was really, really clear to me that I was of service every single second I was at home. So he says, 6 months into sobriety, and he didn't go to a single meeting or work with a single drunk for a year and a half. Did he lose his sobriety? No. In fact, he stayed sane when other people might not have. We don't have to run around looking for glorious ways of being of service. They're some of the most boring, pedestrian, like we tell God, come on, God, give me a glamorous way of being of service. Come on. Make it clear to me that I need to open a soup kitchen and have my picture on the front paper. And God says, I sent you this family, you know? You want to be connected to me? You know, there's a simple basic rule of spiritual fitness, which is an inverse proportion. More you, less him. Less you, more him. That's, you know, the ego is the EGO, the edging God out. So when I'm full of selfishness, I'm not spiritual. When I'm selfless, when I get away from selfishness, when I transcend the ego, then I get full of God. And amazing things happen when I allow that power to be channeled through me. It's not me, it's not by me, but it's through me. Okay? And the best sign that I'm really letting that happen is when I don't mix in and tell God, you know what? You told me that you need me to peel potatoes for the army. I want to be on the front lines. God says, I want you to peel potatoes. What do you want? This is what I assigned you. You want to be of service? This is where I need you. So again, I told you, I'm not a master of interpreting the divine providence of the world. I don't always know when God is sending me a sign. But one sign that I do know how to read is family first. I don't know, does that give you any clarity? Okay. Anything else? Ari, my old friend. Venting?
Yeah.
Okay. I have another question here. Anyone who needs to leave, please feel free to do so. Question is, when is venting bad? Always. Yeah. Yeah, we don't need to vent. If you put up good boundaries and know how to, you know what they say what you mean but don't say it meanly, then there's no reason to vent. Venting is for people who let themselves get walked over over and over and over again until they have to explode to make a point. Anything else? Yeah? Yes.
I have a very good question. I studied a little bit Kabbalah. I want to ask you this. You said suffering. This is your story. Along the road, you're supposed to suffer and say, okay, this is my story. I read the book. And don't do it again. your life will be changed, and that pain and suffering will be removed. No. You know, that's my challenge to you. I want to be happy. Everybody would want to be. God wants us to be happy. The pain is supposed to give us, hello, something wrong. Realize it, pull it out, and just more too. I mean, it's there about even for me, I mean, to realize and pull it out and get rid of the pain. Are we supposed to go to this? Or that's my question. Realize it, take it out, and be happy.
So remember how I mean, these are just my definitions, but how I distinguish between pain and suffering. Pain is the response to the stimulus. And it's helpful and useful because it gets me out of the dangerous situation. Okay? Suffering is afterward when I replay it in my mind and I make it and I relive it. Okay? So are we supposed to go through pain? I don't know if we're supposed to. It's a reality. We do go through pain. I don't know of any life that doesn't entail pain. Pain is sort of unavoidable. Things are going to happen. Not everything God does will I say, oh, that was the perfect next development. I totally agree with that. I couldn't have written that better myself. Sometimes stuff's going to happen, and we're going to say, Tati, that really hurts. That really, really hurts. And that's okay. See, I think one of the things is people are afraid of pain. They're afraid of pain. And there's nothing to be afraid of pain. Like the saying, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, right? Pain too. What's the difference? Remember I was talking about Joseph and his family? So there's another story about Joseph and his family when he was reunited with Benjamin. Benjamin was the brother who didn't throw him in the pit. Can you imagine that? You have 12 boys in your family, and you say, this is my brother Ben, the one who didn't throw me in the pit. Okay, so he reunites with Benjamin, and they're hugging each other, and they're crying, and the Torah says that they're crying on each other's necks. And the commentaries for thousands of years are explaining what this means, and basically what it says is that they had this glimmer of prophecy for a moment. And Joseph sees that many, many generations in the future, Benjamin's children are going to be in the land, in the promised land, the land of Israel. You know, we're talking here, Joseph and Benjamin is before the slavery in Egypt. So it's before the slavery in Egypt, it's for sure before the exodus from Egypt, which is for sure before the 40 years in the desert, which is for sure before they entered the promised land, they divided it up according to tribes, and they built the temple. We're talking hundreds of years before all that. And Joseph sees prophetically that in the future, the tribal land of Benjamin's children is going to have the holy temple in Jerusalem. Just a trivia question, by the way. In which tribal territory is the Holy Temple in Jerusalem? Benjamin. Okay, so Joseph sees that. And he sees that thousands of years later, this temple is going to be destroyed. And he cries. Now at the same moment, Benjamin has this prophetic glimmer. And he sees how in the future, Joseph's children are going to be in the land, in the tribe of Ephraim. Ephraim comes from Joseph. And there's going to be the tabernacle at Shiloh, which is where, you know, the famous story of when Hannah prayed, and you know, how we learn how to pray silently. That happened at the tabernacle in Shiloh. And that's going to get destroyed. And so Benjamin, seeing that this calamity is going to eventually happen in the family of Joseph many, many generations in the future, and they're both crying for each other. Okay, so the simple question is, each one has a impending disaster in his family's future. Cry for yourself. Why are you crying for the other one? So the very simple answer is, oh, compassion. It's not, that's a very simple answer. There's a deeper answer. You know what the deeper answer is? The deeper answer is like this. If a rooster falls in the soot, Talmud says, 1,000 people with 1,000 tiny combs can never make him clean again. But if he gives himself one good shake, he'll be clean. What does that mean? You see your brother, who you love, is on the path to spiritual destruction. Okay, the temple was destroyed physically as an outer manifestation of an inner spiritual destruction. You see your brother is on a path to spiritual destruction. There's a cycle of dysfunction in his family. It might not even manifest for many generations, but you see he's on that path. Okay, and you recognize that's what's happening. And what does the gut response tell you? Jump in there, fix it, save it, stop it. But the true answer is, I can't stop it for him. I can't stop it for him. It's his spiritual path. 1,000 people with 1,000 combs will never make the rooster clean again. But if he gives himself one good shake, he becomes clean instantly. And when I can't do it for you. I can't make you get it. Oh, how I'd love to make you get it. But what does every sick abuser say? I'm just trying to make you get it, right? I can't make you get it. You're going to have your awakening whenever you have your awakening. So if I see you going on a path toward destruction, what's my response? I cry. Crying means I recognize my limitations. I can't stop you, and it hurts to watch you go on this path. You think I'm apathetic? I'm not apathetic. I care a lot, but I'm not going to play God, and I don't fool myself to think that I can have your spiritual awakening for you. I can't have a personal relationship with God for you. I can't do teshuva for you. So I cry. Flip it around now. I'm on a path towards spiritual devastation. I see myself. My character defects are killing me. They're ruining me. Not just spiritually, but there's physically, materially. It's killing my family. It's killing... I can't make a living. I see myself on the path to ruin. And so I cry. No, you don't cry. You know why you don't cry? Because you're supposed to do something about it. God gave you free will. Make some better choices. Because I can have a spiritual awakening for myself. I can have a personal relationship with God for myself. I can have that awakening for myself. In fact, that's the only thing I have control over. The Talmud says everything's in the hands of heaven except for one's awe of heaven. I can't rearrange the chess pieces on the board to make everyone behave the way that I want them to behave. But I can change my attitude toward my Father in heaven. And I can sort of get a perspective that works. A perspective from which I'll make better decisions for myself. I can change myself. So I don't cry. If I'm heading down a path to spiritual ruin, I don't cry. I try to figure out what decisions do I have to make. So to answer your question very simply, pain is inevitable. When it arises, and I ask myself, is this something that I'm doing? So I got to change my behavior. Is this something that you're doing? I can't change your behavior. Is this something you're doing to me? I got to put up a better boundary. Each one of these has a different answer that's appropriate to that question. Or the way that I heard it once put, this lady once told me, she goes through life and everything that happens to her, she puts in one of three columns. She makes like a chart, just three columns. Anything that happens to her, she puts it in one of three columns. My business, God's business, none of my business. Okay. This is the late crowd. These are people that really, really love this stuff. Is there any more questions? One more, a little something? Or are we good? We're, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but thank him for it first. And if it's a painful thing that you don't really feel in the mood of thanking him for, then at least bring yourself to say, God, this is really real. At the very least, just acknowledge this is really real. Put yourself in reality. Embrace the reality. Remember, that relationship with God is supposed to put you in life. It's supposed to put you in reality. Not take you out of it. There's two concepts that are always confused for one another. Because people don't know the definition of them. But once you know the definition of either of them, you never confuse them with each other again. In fact, you realize they're opposites. Those two concepts are fantasy and faith. What's the difference between fantasy and faith? Fantasy is an idea that I cling to in order to avoid facing reality. Faith is an idea that I cling to in order to give me the courage to face reality. So, in other words, you want to know if you are reckless or courageous? Very simple distinction. Are your eyes closed or are your eyes open? If your eyes are closed, that's reckless. If your eyes are open, that's courage. Okay, so the least we can do when God creates the entire universe, something from nothing, just so I can have another experience, the least I can do is say, God, this is really real. This is real. I'm affirming the reality of it. And it's funny, by the way, because, you know, Moda Ani Lefanecha, we say the first thing out of our mouth, hopefully, when we get out of bed, instead of like, oh, shoot, I missed the alarm again. It should be Moda Ani Lefanecha. The word Moda is an interesting word in Hebrew. We translate it aloud as thanks, but that doesn't do justice to it. Like, todah is thanks. But it really is from the word hoda'ah, which means admission or acknowledgement. Okay? And what's a Yehudi, a Jew? One who gives thanks or gives admission or acknowledgement. All right? So a Jew is one who gives admission or acknowledgement or thanks. It's interesting because a lot of people, they say, I will not acknowledge something until I'm grateful for it. Right? If I don't like a certain aspect of reality, I reserve the right to live in denial until the situation changes to my liking. If I don't feel grateful for it, I won't acknowledge it. It's not real. A Jew, a Yehudi, is one who is grateful for it because he acknowledges it. I am thankful for this moment for no other reason than just the fact that it is really real. It's real. And it's coming from the author of reality. And that's a mind-blowing concept. It's a mind-blowing concept. And your homework is to go take this piece of information, run it through your thinking, put it down in your heart, and get some of those amazing liberating emotions, freedom and joy and serenity, sense of purpose. It's a mind-blowing concept. It's happening. It's really happening. It's happening all for you. It's your story. It's your life. And it couldn't be any other way for now. Okay, thanks everybody so much. Good night.